the first question is, what is the primary or fundamental intention you have in relationship to your spiritual practice? Is a primary aspiration or sense of purpose or intention. And the second question, what is the primary obstacle you have or hindrance to following through on that intention? Third question, what is the primary opportunity you have to follow through on that intention, aspiration, sense of purpose? And the final question, considering your primary intention or sense of purpose for a spiritual life, if you could ask a wise person, the Buddha perhaps, one question, what would that one question be? Given your intention, if you were going to ask one question, what would that question be? There is space in here. If those in the outer hall want to come in, you're welcome to do that. So, good morning. And I asked you a series of questions. And, you know, the primary responsibility for Buddhist practice lies with you. And there's only so much that books or teachers or can really do for you. Unless you somehow put yourself into it. And one of the good ways of putting yourself into it is to have good questions, have questions you address, questions you try to respond to, and also to come up with questions. And so you start with yourself, given who you are, given what your situation is, given your life, the life that you're part of, what questions do you have that somehow relate to spiritual life, a Buddhist life, a life of liberation, a life that somehow comes out of your primary values and primary intentions for your life? In order to have good questions, you have to have I think hopefully a good sense of intentionality, a sense of purpose, aspiration. Though one of the great questions is, what is my intention? What is my sense of purpose? You don't have to have an answer, but even that's a good exploration. I was told by one of the teachers at San Francisco Zen Center that he defined Zen training, Zen practice, as a process of purifying one's intention. So you have an intention, and then you kind of work on that, and you purify it, you refine it, you deepen it over time. And another teacher at the Zen Center said that encouraged us to come to him with our questions, but not without having reflected on them for a long time ourselves. And so to not just ask the question easily, but to do the homework of, you know. And sometimes it took a long time before you could interview with a teacher there, so you had a lot of time. And so the idea was to refine the question until you could find, his expression was, the kernel of the question, the essence of the question. And I found doing that, that actually many of the times the first wording of the question was a little bit abstract or distant or not quite to the point. And spending time with the question, getting to the kernel, the heart, what was really the issue, it was very, very valuable. And occasionally then the question didn't have to be answered, or be asked. It's kind of somehow that my own inner process with the question was what was important. So we could do two things. We could do a lot of things here this morning. But we could do two things I'm thinking of. One is that you could ask me your questions. And depending on the kind of question you want to say, the question you have, I could try to respond some way or other, if it seems appropriate, or I can just thank you for the question. Or we can just spend next half an hour or so, or next period of time, hearing from different people what their question is. And I don't respond at all. Because that, Partly because that might be disrespectful of your process. Who am I to respond to deep questions of yours? And also, it might be really actually very interesting and very kind of deepening for all of us to hear a lot of the kind of questions you might have come up with. So what should we do? Just questions? Number two, just questions. Well, the people who seem to have some enthusiasm, yeah? Just questions. Well, the people who want answers are being awfully quiet. And I was also taught that in this kinds of circles, in Buddhist circles, there are no bad questions. So that all questions are kind of windows or doors or something. They're important. And I was also taught that I think it comes from an ancient Buddhist Mahayana Buddhist sutra that you get really good karma for asking questions. So I'm very eager to hear some of these questions you might have had. So someone, good to use the mic so people can hear. And so who would like to start and break the ice? Right behind you, Linda.
So my question is actually very simple. I think I know the path. How do I get myself to do it more regularly and in a more habituated way?
So the question is, do you think you know the path? And how do you get to it more regularly and habitually?
How do I get myself to do it?
Do it. Great. Thank you.
My question, I think, arises from one of the sutta readings. I can't remember which one it was, but the number, but it's where the various speakers are answering the question, how to enlighten the solid tree. And I was, and at the very end, the Buddha gives his answer. And I don't remember it exactly, but I was sort of curious to hear him say that after the alms rounds or whatever, that you would come back to your city, and sit as long as you needed to stop clinging. And I was just curious about whether or not that referred to the bhikkhus, or and not the arhants, and not to Buddha himself. I'm assuming that once you become enlightened, you've let go of the clinging, and so he wasn't referring to the arhants or himself. Mm-hmm. He was referring to the bhikkhus and the rest of us. But I was sort of curious about that.
Yeah, it's a great question. So the question, those of you who weren't there, in the Sutta study class, one of the discourses of the Buddha we read was some senior disciples of the Buddha were sitting around talking in a beautiful natural setting. And they asked each other the question, who would illuminate this beautiful natural setting? And so each of them answers according to their own specialty, their own mastery. So the person who has a great memory says, the person who's memorized and learned a lot of teachings of the Buddha would illuminate. The person who has great meditation experience says, the person who's meditated great, a great meditator would illuminate the setting. The person who has great practice. The person who has great ability to analyze the Dharma. So they each kind of, and the Buddha says, great. Each of you had great answers according to your own capacity. And then they asked him, who would you say illuminates this beautiful place? And the Buddha said what Hilary said, that the person who comes back, the monk who comes back from his alms round, sits down to meditate, and and in order to, and sits there without getting up until awakened and becoming free of all clinging. So that expression of the Buddha that really was meaningful for Hillary, and she had some questions around that. What does that mean? And I can imagine that it's a little bit of, you know, that statement like that is a challenge to many of us, because what? Sit down and not get up until we've let go of our clinging? Well, I can let go of some of my stress, but, you know, I know enough about what the Buddha is teaching that, you know, there's a lot of clinging that doesn't, you know, it's not, you know, maybe it's not obviously there, day-to-day living, but once you just quiet down, you see there's a lot. So what does it mean to sit there until there's no more clinging? And then partly what I heard in your question is also, what's the relationship maybe between someone sitting here like a Buddha and the non-clinging of other people? How do we relate to each other in our practice? Thank you. Someone else?
I'm wondering if enduring peace and serenity is possible, and whether it would require a period of monastic life.
Mm-hmm. Great. So is enduring peace and serenity possible? That's a good question. And the expression enduring is also a very rich one. And then it does require a period of monastic life. Thank you.
Several years ago, I heard, I don't know how to pronounce his name, Sungnyal Rinpoche speak, the guy who wrote Tibetan Book of Living and Dying. So he's this really jovial, jolly guy, and he comes out on the stage of some big auditorium in San Francisco just chuckling about getting your bags packed because you don't know when the train is coming. And so my question is, you know, what is death? And am I going to be ready?
Mm. So you have getting your bags packed because you don't know when the train is coming.
And it's getting ready for death.
Yeah. And so what does it mean to get ready? And how much baggage can you take with you? I think there's a limit. It's a good question. Thank you. Many people, plenty of people, engage in Buddhism as a preparation for dying, or in response to the whole death thing. Thank you. Up on the stage, Maria.
Some of my questions were sort of wanting to know the future. And another question was sort of, is it really possible to move ahead as a group of people, human beings, because those who are achieving wisdom and enlightenment keep dying off and being replaced by young people who are ignorant of the world of the past. So my question is it really possible to move forward, or is you always starting over because of that?
So another, as a group? So
yeah, is there looking at human beings as a whole.
Is there social development, evolution, development, growth? And or we, you know, if it's our fate to kind of just go over the same wheel, growth and decay and rediscovery over and over again, make the same mistakes over again. Thank you. Right here.
My question is there a relationship between how we treat the outside world and how we treat ourselves? And is it, you know, how do we understand that relationship?
Great. So what's the relationship between self and other, how we behave towards others and our inner life? And it's a great question to explore.
My question is about letting go. I understand, the way I understand the idea around letting go is you do whatever you can, and the maximum of what you can about something. You reach whatever result you can reach, and then you let go. It doesn't mean you just sit down and forget about everything. But then the question is, when do you know how to stop or where to stop? You can always think there's more to do. There's more to achieve. And then I don't find the solution, because you cannot let go because you never know when you have done your max.
It's an interesting question. So if letting go is relevant, only relevant once you've done your best, then how do you know when you've done your best and when it's time to let go? It's a great question. And I'm not supposed to respond. Thank you. I'll let go.
We live in a culture that stresses achievement and doing things and being successful. And I guess the question that I have is that how does this, when it bumps up against the Buddha's way to live, and maybe it's similar to the other man's question, when do you say enough is enough?
So we live in a society of achievement and accumulation, certain values, and how does those values of our culture relate to the values of Buddhism or the practice of Buddhism? What happens when they're in conflict, seemingly in conflict? It's a great question.
Can I say one more thing?
Yes.
This is also temple cleaning day, so... if those who would like to work outside, it's a beautiful day. We'll meet by the back door.
Great. we'll take time for announcements before the end, because other ones of you are wondering when they're going to happen. All the way in the back. So. Wait for the mic. Thank you.
My question is clinging to not clinging still clinging?
Thank you. It's actually a very, very important question, and I would hope that the answer is found in the question. Someone else?
This question seems to be so obvious and simple that it boggles my mind that I have so much difficulty with it. The nature of delusion and the nature of wakefulness when I'm relatively wakeful, or I feel like I'm wakeful and mindful, the sense of ease and liberation is so wonderful and overwhelming. And then when I'm so deluded, I'm so far away from mindfulness. And I just wonder, how could I, and I know the answer, how could I change my delusion enough or work on my delusion enough so that I was not so far away from mindfulness?
Great question. Thank you. Great question. Questions, certain questions like that can, you know, sustain one and keep one busy for a long time. The, you know, some questions might have obvious answers. Like you said, you have an answer. But some, there's one thing to have an answer. There's another thing to live the answer. And so to repeatedly come back to the same question over and over again allows us to kind of live the answer, live the question in different ways, in different settings, in different situations. So having a really primary, some Buddhist practitioners in their life love having a primary question that they carry with them over and over and over again, and they apply it to different situations. So, thank you.
My question also came from reading the sutta about the sala tree grove and the six bhikkhus who each had a different strength in their practice. And I noticed that there are some elements of practice expressed by those bhikkhus that I find easier and more enjoyable and would rather do more of, and there are some that I find more challenging. And my question is, if I find these more enjoyable, are they my strengths, and should I pursue those, or should I find more of a balance and try to pursue the ones that are harder?
Great question. That's a good one. So it also relates to the question of you said your strengths, but also our preferences. You know, how do we choose? Do we choose what we prefer? Do we choose what's easy for us? Do we choose what's difficult? There's so many things one could do, and what basis do we make choices like that? Thank you. Over here, please, to Lauren.
This is not meant to be facetious at all, but a lot of times when you ask us for contemplations about what is your greatest question, my mind just shuts down. So honestly, my question really is, how do I open myself up to questions and not just keep looking for answers?
Thank you.
How do you know what your obstacles are if they don't reveal themselves to you?
How do you know what your obstacles are when they don't reveal themselves to you? It's a great question. Some people can have a sense that something's standing in the way, but it's not obvious, not clear. Something is preventing us from answering questions or having questions. But what is that? To refer back to the previous question. Thank you. It relates also to the whole question, the question of what areas of our life are we basically unconscious or about that we don't understand, don't see, that are important? They're somehow operating and influencing us and having effects on us. How do we get in touch with the unknown forces within us, the unknown motivations and choices and beliefs and feelings and things that are somehow having a big impact on us?
I find that the more relaxed I am in my meditation, the more natural my breathing is. But when I'm trying to focus on my breathing and really try to regulate it, and really focus on is it smooth, is it jagged, is it long, is it short, and all those other qualities, that it immediately becomes quite unnatural. So I'm still having an obstacle with making my breathing the way I want it to be.
So the question is how to pay attention carefully to your breathing and not interfere with it. Great, thank you.
I've got a question. Why is the world so screwed up? Burma is just the latest example of that. But
why is the world so screwed up? And Burma is the latest example of this.
According to Hindu teachings, we are in the Dwapara Yuga, ascending toward the light.
Ascending toward the light?
Ascending toward the light.
Oh, good. So the whole question of the state of the world, why is it the way it is, and what's our relationship to that? Because the state of the world, for many people, there's a big impact the state of the world has on individuals. And our sense of hope, our sense of aspiration, what we want to do with our life, is often very motivated by what we see around us and what's going on in the world around us. So the question is, what is going around? What is going on out there? So the earlier question was, you know, are we all evolving to some great, wonderful, beautiful climax? Are we evolving in some direction? Or is it, you know, cyclical, just over and over again, have to repeat the same problems? And what good are my individual efforts if the world, if it doesn't help or support the world in some way? Anyway, so thank you. Someone has two questions, isn't that great?
That just reminded me of a question that came up. On a very concrete level, it was, how can I plan and prepare for the Dharma Friends hike this afternoon if I'm staying in the moment? And sort of the more general question is, how can you be in the moment and yet, you know, move forward
Great.
With your goals?
Yeah, so how do you plan? How do you hold some goal in the future? How do you plan for something in the future if you're only staying in the moment? So like I like to joke with my friends that I'll plan 2 years in advance to be someplace in order to tell people to be here and now. Thank you for all those questions. And my hope in having them kind of stated today is that for all of you that you certainly find it valuable to reflect on questions, and the range of questions maybe simulate different questions for you, curiosities, interests. But the more important that it just kind of, rather than leaving today inspired by answers or certainty or, you know, in some great way, but you're inspired to actually engage in your life with a certain kind of depth of, I don't know if seriousness is the right word, but a certain kind of depth that allows you, or encourages you to stay questioning. What is this? What's going on here? And there's big questions about your life that you can hold and explore, but there's also the questions of the moment. You know, any situation you find yourself in is a completely open situation. And every situation you find yourself in is, in some ways, an unknown situation. And it's unknown in many ways. And one of the unknown ways can be expressed in the question, where is liberation found in this situation? Or where is compassion found in this situation? Or what is the greatest need that this situation here is calling forth? What's the request of the situation I find myself in? And that was a kind of a Zen question that sometimes was encouraged, was, what's the request of the situation? And the situation, that to me, in my mind, is not just the external situation, it's not just your inner situation, but the whole situation includes you. So given this whole thing that's happening here and now, what's the request? As opposed to, what do I want? And if the request, again, includes what's needed inside, what arises inside, it's very inclusive. But it's not limited to self or other, but it's very, you know, it's all inclusive. So what's the request of the moment? And so we walk into situations, even situations that we maybe experienced many times before, and we think we know all the answers, we already know. What's the request of the moment? What's this given, you know, this particular conjuncture of combination of causes and conditions will never happen again, never happen before. So to enter in with, you know, what is this? What is this? What's the request? What's the need? What's where's liberation? Where's compassion? So having questions or asking questions, being ready to have questions rather than certainty, I think is very powerful because it opens up opens things up to new perspectives, but also to new possibilities. And one of those possibilities, I hope, is the possibility for you to become freer, become more liberated, to become more, you know, less clinging or less afraid or less less imposing on the situation preconceived ideas or preconceived or bringing to the situation preconceived sense of who you are and what your needs are, and, you know, everything. Just, there's much more sense of openness, open to possibility, open to find out new. And it's my sense that, a very strong sense that, you know, every day I wake up or every situation I come into, I'm kind of a new person. You know, in a sense, I don't really know who I am until I've entered the situation. The situation that I'm in helps teach me who I am. And so for me to come with a pre-existing idea of Gil, you know, is kind of limited. But to come with some sense of, who am I? Who am I now? Well, what's the situation? What's this world now? When I come into it, and then we all discover together. The questions earlier of the relationship between the external world and ourselves was a great question. And I certainly don't see it as being a hard and fast division line between the world and self. And the situation of the world we find ourselves in shapes us, defines us. And who we are defines and shapes the situation to some degree. It's a mutual thing that arises together. And again, so and as mutual, you know, it's always shifting and changing. So to have the sense of question, what is this? What's going on here? Some kind of question that helps open it up can be very helpful. But I think it also can be, more importantly perhaps, it can be liberating and helpful. If you don't have questions, it's okay not to have questions. And there's certainly, I think, a very valid spiritual path without a question, I suppose. But still ringing, isn't it? But the questions, but to have questions, there's a great potential to kind of open things up. So, I guess, you know, the inspired answer to life's issues that you hopefully take today is, you know, the interest in being a questioner. And if you leave from here and are more inclined to ask more questions in the course of the day, great, that'd be really great. So thank you very much. So go forth with your questions.